Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Barbican Station. Hello and welcome to Barbican Station, a podcast looking at the works of Mick Herron from the website Spywrite. My name's Jeff and I love reading and writing about espionage fiction. I'd previously mentioned Dolphin Junction would be our next episode. I hit a minor snag on that and it'll be coming after this one. That said, I'm really excited about the book we're talking about and my guest for this episode. I'm pleased to welcome H.C. Newton to the show. Newton's blog, Irresponsible Reader, has daily reviews of books from all genres. I'm truly impressed by not only his output, but also his thoughtful ideas about the books he reads. H.C., thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was a fun read. It was a great experience so far. Let's see if I can ruin that in the next conversation.
This episode, we're going to be talking about Herron's standalone novel, Reconstruction. Given this might be a lesser read book, we're going to start out basically spoiler-free to get things rolling and give a warning when we're really going to start to break things down. But before we get too far, I wanted to ask you, how did you start your blog? Like, what got you into doing that?
There was a period, like a decade or so, where I was just reading so quickly, I really wasn't even thinking about the books I was going through. It was, it was just mindless. It felt wrong to me. It felt like I was disrespecting the work. No one else in the world cared. Authors liked the fact that I was buying the books, but it bugged me. So that's about when Goodreads was kind of taking off, and I was trying to force myself to write about everything there. But I would get busy or distracted. I wouldn't do it. There was no pressure. So I'd heard about book blogs, and I thought, well, let me do that. I mean, I had a personal blog, but no one ever liked any of my book stuff. family stuff, if I talked about TV or sports, that would get something, but books, nothing. So I heard about book blogs, never read one. I'm like, you know what? I'll do that. If only because if I stopped, it would be obvious. On Goodreads, no one could tell if I stopped. But on a book blog, if I stopped doing it, I would at least notice. So I just, all right, I'm going to actually stop and think about whatever I'm reading. Write something, two or three paragraphs, several paragraphs. I tend more that way lately. And yeah, it was mostly just a way to force myself to actually pause on whatever I was reading. I mean, whether it was a classic or a contemporary thing, I was just going through them like tissue paper. And that just didn't seem right.
And how long have you been doing it now? And how many books do you think you've reviewed?
Oh, gosh. I have been at this for 7.5 years, I think. That sounds about right. Number of books reviewed. I think I've talked about. Review sounds like something that professionals do, and I'm just a guy with a hobby. I've talked about, the last couple of years, I have talked about at least 150. No, I was about to say at least 150, but that seems underwhelming. Yeah, the last couple of years have been almost daily. Not necessarily always a post about one specific book, but I try that way. Yeah, no, it's got to be around 1,000 by this point, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a great resource too for getting a look at some of the stuff that's out there.
I hope so. Yeah.
Now, you're still a relative newbie to Mick Herron, right?
I am.
You did read Slow Horses, right? And I was curious what your thoughts on that one was.
I really enjoyed it. I didn't get the hype surrounding him, but I really liked it, and I wanted to continue, and I got distracted, like as I frequently do. And then last year, an audiobook retailer had it on sale, so I grabbed it to kind of re-listen, this will spur me on to the next book. Really good audiobook. Again, I enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done, but it didn't grab me the way I wanted it to, and I never moved on. I have one friend who threatens me with physical harm monthly because I haven't moved on to book two yet. He was very excited when I asked him for advice, when you gave me a list of titles and I asked him which one. He was very excited about the fact that I was doing this.
Nice. Well, I definitely think, overall the series, for me, my favorite is the third book. And I feel like that's when it really clicked into place, a lot of the things. Okay. You could still see, and I think we'll get into that with this book, there's a lot of things that he was kind of working on in this book that come fuller into focus with Slow Horses and even more so in the later ones. I think he finally kind of refines what his focus is and what he is, some of the themes that he likes to focus on. Okay, so one of the other things that I think is really interesting about this book for folks listening to know is that it's basically a prequel to the Slow Horses series. because we see characters in this book appear in mm-hmm. Slow Horses in some of the later books, and sure. and it gets referenced in a couple of different ways definitely in Slow Horses. And it also serves as kind of a connective tissue to Heron's previous series, the Oxford series of mysteries that he had. So it's kind of like right in the middle there, creating this kind mm-hmm. of Heron universe, which is interesting.
So I have seen some things list this as part of that Oxford series. You don't see it that way?
No, it's completely separate from all of that. I'm not quite sure why they group it there. Honestly, mm-hmm. it's closer to Slow Horses. I would group it with that. Okay. Although there's some changes, you know, he does some changes in there. He talks about the spies involved in this book are MI6, in Slow Horses they're MI5, but it's definitely mm-hmm. the same people that you see crossover.
Okay.
And so you can see him like testing out a lot of the things that come up later in Slow Horses. He's using some of those characters and some of those ideas. So
sure.
So, did you like this one?
Oh, I did. I did. Just the narration right at the get-go, I was like, this is great. And then the hook got set really quickly, and it just kept digging in more and more and more. And, you know, by the end, this was one of those, you know, stop talking to me, wife, go away, son, dog, shoo, you know. I need to focus on this, because this is more important than you right now.
So the book follows several people whose lives intersect when a man with a gun holes up in a daycare center here in the U.S., nursery in the U.K. This man calls for a spy to come talk with him for some sort of reason, and we start to realize there's something bigger going on here. This isn't just some Yeah. random occurrence. These people are connected in some sort of weird way, and it's really sneaky in the way that it lays some of the groundwork for how these connections are or aren't in place.
Sneaky is a great word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So some of the people that I will talk through a few of the people, and then we'll maybe get into some more spoiler stuff here. You know, first, it really does a good job in the first few pages of just setting up the various characters that we're going to meet.
Including like one guy that we see for like, maybe like total of 8 or 10 pages, and they say, okay, we're not going to see him again. Wait. I liked this guy. I got invested in this guy, and now I'm done with him? What? Come on.
Well, we've got Louise Kennedy, who is a former high-flying bank exec who kind of chucked it all to go work at a daycare center. Mm-hmm. And she's dealing with her mother, living with her, and you know, just kind of dealing with that. We've got Elliot Pedlar, I think is his last name.
Yeah.
And he is a dad to two of the kids that are going to this daycare center, Timmy and Gordon, and he's taking them today. Not usually something that he does, but today he's going to take them and drop them off. And we run into Judy, who is living this just miserable life after a divorce, right? I mean, and she's really...
Yeah.
You know, Heron does a good job of making her both sympathetic and kind of a person you would not want to be around.
Yeah, she's Eeyore without the likability factor.
Yes. Yeah, and then we also meet somebody that later just for a while, there's this thing that we meet the young man that's going to be in this daycare center holding everybody hostage, right? And mm-hmm. they do this thing where everybody refers to him as the gun.
Yeah. You
know, that's his name for a while, which I thought was really a great way of not only kind of making him like this other person, but it like makes the gun almost an animated object that I thought mm-hmm. was a really interesting choice.
Yeah, there are sections the gun is being personified. The guy holding it doesn't really matter. It's the gun.
Yeah.
And that's what people remember. That's the pictures they'll walk away with. You know, if they survive this, you know, in 10 years, they might remember his name, but they'll remember that gun till the end.
There's something that happens early on that I wanted to talk to you about, because I was curious about what your opinion is. Very early on, there's this moment where the narrator, like, jumps in and, like, actually talks, right?
Yeah.
And that was so, it was kind of odd, but interesting. And I was curious what your thoughts are on there, because they only appear at the very beginning. And it even references, you know, you'll never hear from me again. But it's the perspective of somebody who is headed to work, that lives in Oxford, going into the city, and talks about, you know, just the interactions of these people, and kind of sets out the themes a little bit too.
Yeah, I was really crushed at that point. Like, that's the first time the narrator mentions that they're a narrator. But, you know, they're going to work at the same time all these other people are. They just, you know, there's a little snapshot. And not only you're not going to see that other guy again, you're not going to hear from me again. And like, then why did I hear from you at all? But I don't care, because that was one of those moments like, something strange is going to be going on if they're calling attention to the fact that we're done with them. That something big is about to happen, and the narrator isn't important.
Yeah.
Although, maybe come back to this at the end, because one of the things I've been chewing on a lot in the few weeks since I read this book is the title. And I do think the narrator is kind of important in that.
Yes, I agree.
Explaining the title.
Yeah. I agree. I think you're exactly right there. And I think, you know, this whole book, and I don't think this is a spoiler, it is about kind of reconstruction of this event, right? Of looking at all of the different aspects of this event and how it's all put together. And I think there's certain things at the end that you've constructed one way of looking at things. And by the end, you're forced to reconstitute that in a different way because your perspective shifts.
Right, yeah.
And I think one of the themes that we'll get into, I think, is a shift of perspective and how you need to reconstruct that perspective of other people that you might have looked at differently previously.
And I did wonder if that narrator, because I read that this was part of the series, is that narrator someone from those Oxford mysteries? Nope.
No, I don't think so. You know, what it read like, honestly, is because at the time that this was happening, Heron was living in Oxford. He was working in London. It almost felt like it was literally Heron saying, "This is a story that I know, and I'm going to tell you now." It almost felt like him kind of sticking his, his author's hand in here and stirring things up a little bit, which I thought was kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's kind of the setup. You know that we enjoyed it. You know, if you haven't read it, I do think it's a crucial read for anybody who enjoyed the Slow Horses series. I think it gives a little bit more depth into some of the stuff going on. There's certain characters that reappear. But with that said, we are going to dive into some spoilers, because I really do want to talk about a lot of what happens in here. So we're going to, you know, feel free to pause, go read the book, and then come back and listen to us really get down and dirty on what goes on here. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Exploring the works of John le Carré, each episode of the Le Carré Cast looks at a specific novel or an unexplored aspect of his life and work. Join us as we take a deep dive into the world of espionage John le Carré has revealed. Search for Le Carré Cast wherever you listen to podcasts or at lecarrecast.com. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show, like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart, to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network. Okay. So, what do you think about, you know, like these characters and what's going on? Let's talk a little bit about this. I'd say it's kind of separated into three sections, so maybe we take it in those sections. There's the part where we get everybody together. There's the part where they're trapped in the palace, which is the name of this little kind of annex that they have, that they're trapped. These five people are, or six people are trapped in. And then there's kind of the exit where we get everybody is out of the palace, and then we kind of shoot off into this whole different direction in the story, right?
Yeah. You think it's a denouement, but no, denouement, excuse me. But no, it's not.
So let's talk about how we end up with everybody together. You know, this gun comes in and holds everybody up, but we've already kind of gotten to know everybody, right?
Right, yeah. We just, at least we think we've got, got to know them. We've got a good introduction. We kind of understand where they are in life. We see if the gun doesn't show up, this is still going to be kind of an interesting day for these five, or at least Louise and Elliot and the kids. It's going to be an interesting day.
Yeah.
Judy never has an interesting day. and she'd love to tell you about that. But so it's going to be a take out the gun. This is a pretty good family drama kind of novel.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Richard Russo or Jennifer Weiner novel just waiting to happen. But no, then the gun shows up and it becomes a very different kind of day. You really almost immediately, I don't know if what I thought about Louise, but she realizes what's going on, and she puts herself out there to prevent other students and other staff members from being exposed to the gun, or you know, or to Jamie. Which, like, okay, I'm in with this lady for the rest of the book at this point because of that.
Yeah, one of the things that we find out is that Elliot and Louise have this kind of quasi-relationship. You know, at the very beginning, we know there's something going on. We don't know the full extent of what exactly has happened here. But, and I don't know, you know, the first time I read it, I don't know if I as immediately picked up that Louise is like basically our hero of the story, right? She's the person that we're going to focus on as that. I don't know if I necessarily picked that up immediately the first time through, just because he did such a good job of kind of creating so many different characters that you're kind of invested in, that you're not quite sure how it's going to spin off, right?
Yeah, it takes a long time before, Louise really is one. But just the way that she locks those five in and blocks everyone out is like, okay, I like her. I'm invested in this character. These other people, I don't know. I'm interested in Louise and the gun at this point. The guy hunting the gun is kind of interesting just because, well, he's theoretically the good guy.
Yeah. They're all there and they're kind of trapped there. And then Louise manages to rescue everybody and runs back in, you know, back into the, into the palace. And one of the things that was interesting to me is just how everybody else's reaction to that, right? Because they all think she's kind of they either think she's got something to do with why this is happening, or that she's crazy, right? Like, why would you go back in there?
One of these two things. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not seeing that she saved a whole lot of people, or potentially saved a whole lot of people. They're just thinking she's a co-conspirator, or suicidal, maybe. Who knows? But yeah, that's a perspective that the reader brings. Oh, she's our gal. Every other character, there's something wrong with this woman.
And the other part of it is just that there's Elliot and her, and it's slowly like this. I would call this novel, more than some of Heron's others, is really one of those onion peelers, right? Where every as you go along, a little bit more, another slice of the onion comes off there, you know, and you see a little bit clearer what's going on. And that's definitely the case with Elliot and Louise. You know, they had managed to, we find out that they had gone to this pub quiz a few days before and ended up having this one night stand. It was just kind of like neither of them would have ever like expected that day to turn out that way.
Right.
And it does. And what I like that Heron does is we get to see all of this from both Louise's side and Elliot's side, and they're both like kind of talking past each other, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's a one-night stand for one of them. I don't know that it's a one-night stand for both of them.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Elliot is basically, his marriage is kind of stalling out at this point, right? Yeah. He's got these 2 4-year-old twins, and he feels, now whether this is reality, I think is maybe debatable, that his wife has fully just invested in the children and not invested in him anymore. And and he's like an interloper almost in the relationship.
Yeah, he definitely feels he's there to work and stay out of her way. Because it doesn't matter what he does. She's not going to see him involved with the kids. She doesn't talk to him. Their love life is pretty much dead. They just kind of live together. I think he might be right. when you see his wife get to the school, she's focused on her kids and their well-being. And, Elliot. He's not, you know, excusing his affair, but you know what? I think there's something not right in the marriage for sure.
Definitely. Well, and she even, I think, acknowledges that, because we do get a scene of her later on when she finds out what happened, right? Because the reason Elliot is dropping the kids off today is because she was going to go back to where she previously worked and check right. in there, because she had been, she'd worked in a lawyer's office as doing some sort of something there. And
a paralegal kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it felt like. So she goes there and starts getting kind of invested in going back, and actually has a really good, you know, she sees a way, maybe do something different than the way things were going, where she's just yeah. at home with the kids and completely focused on them. And you get the sense that if this hadn't happened, that maybe that framing, you know, maybe something would have finally kind of shifted in their marriage if she'd gone back to work, and they kind of could yeah. have gotten back onto the maybe more of an equilibrium. Mm-hmm. But that's not meant to be because of this no. Gun going into the school. The other thing that I really wanted to say is that for me as a reader, and I don't know how you feel, I'm curious to get your opinion on this. Just because I have kids now, I do not enjoy books where authors use children in peril as a way of creating, I would call it like false stakes, right? Because I feel like it's a way of upping the ante that can be cheap if not done very well.
Yeah, there's a exploitative nature to a lot of the way that kids become in peril in various books. And I'm with you. It feels cheap, feels uncomfortable. But there are some authors who do it really well. There's a whole lot of rules when it comes to writing and grammar and stuff like that, unless you're good, and then do whatever. Actually, I think I made that reference to Heron recently. I was talking to someone, and the tone of the narration doesn't match the tone of the book. Mm. And I was like, people shouldn't do that. But he can, because he's really good at it.
Yeah.
And same thing with Kids in Peril. Or Brad Parks. I don't know if you've ever read any of Brad Parks.
Yeah.
But when he broke away from his series and started doing the standalones, someone told him, what's the scariest thing that could happen in your life? And he came up with this idea, well, my kid's being kidnapped. That's the scariest thing that could happen to me. And so that's what he did, and it was really well done. Mm-hmm. Other authors could have taken that setup that he did with the judge's kids being kidnapped, and it would have been a mess. I think Heron, honestly, I never worried about the twins.
Yes.
In this particular daycare, they were safe. They you know, shifted the action a little bit every now and then, but I was never worried about them.
Yes, I agree. You know, you're right. I mean, I read that book, Brad Parks' book, mm-hmm. with the kids, and I think you're right. That was less exploitative than a lot of other ones. I think Heron does it well here as well, where you're not worried about Timmy and Gordon, and he does a good job of, it's only those two, number one, right? It's not like we have an entire yeah. classroom full of kids, and you don't feel like whatever happens, you don't feel like they're in danger. There's just the general danger. And I think some of that is due to the flashback structure, where you're kind of bouncing around. And so the tension in the classroom never becomes overwhelming. Like there's certain True. Moments where it hits peaks, but then there's a valley where you can kind of look away from that situation. And I think that helps diminish some of that worry in my mind.
Yeah, I think so. And if there is any threat to the twins, it's not from the gun. Mm. Maybe it's from the police. If they end up storming the palace,
yeah.
you know, then a whole lot could go wrong. I don't know how often Jamie is aware that the kids are around. He's so focused on his stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about him, because Jamie is the gun, mm-hmm. and he doesn't speak English as a first language, which is one of the kind of barriers that we first encounter with any sort of discussion with him, right? He's kind of right. stumbled into this situation. He's not there truly, we find out. It's not like he's there to... Holding people hostage was not his first intent on showing up there.
No, he
was on the run, and he saw these two guys that we later learn out are MI6 guys come to mm-hmm. collect him, like a what is it, a collect and comfort, or comfort and collect.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he goes on through a set of circumstances that is kind of amusing, even if it is rather gruesome. One of the other guys ends up getting hit by a car and in intensive care, right?
Yeah, and oh, that was one of the all-time best guy hit by a car scenes. Heron's description of that, I don't know how many, I stopped reading and went back and read that two or three times at least, if not more. Actually, I think one of my kids was walking by and like, oh, stop, stop, stop. You got to hear this. And I read that section and they gave me a weird look and moved on. But it was just so really well done. And yeah, you're right. It's kind of comic, but not. and I guess kind of the way that Tarantino can use things for being comic. And yeah, which gets Jamie on the run. He's been worried about his boyfriend or whatever their relationship is. He's been worried about him. And now he's on the run. And he just knows that if he gets to the school and talks to the lady, he's got a chance of making things all right. If he can just get there.
Yeah.
And the gun isn't for hostage taking. He just happens to have one. And it makes people pay attention to him.
Right, because the guy that was coming to pick him up had a gun, and when he gets hit, it kind of skitters into the feet of JB, and so he just picks it up and heads out. So it wasn't like it was he even had it. It was just if these two MI6 guys hadn't screwed up, there's no way he would have had a gun. And that's part of the tension that we then later find between Bad Sam, who's the living MI6 guy, who goes to talk with the cops because the cops are not happy that somebody got hit on their path. And now there's a gun loose out there that's an actual MI6 weapon, right?
Yeah, the guy should have even pulled his gun. If he hadn't pulled his gun in the first place, Jamie wouldn't have had it. This whole day goes much differently.
And so Jamie ends up, stumbling on accidentally. That's one of the things that this mysterious narrator notes, right? That they don't even know how he managed to get there from one place to the other. They've tried to figure it out and they can't. But he makes it to the nursery and gets in there and starts asking for the lady. And he also asks for somebody else. He asks for Whistler, Ben Whistler. Yeah. And this is when we meet our other, what I would say our impression is as the main kind of lead hero, right?
Yeah, this is our hero by accident. He's just an accountant. He works for, intelligence services, but he's not a spy. He's the guy that approves their purchase orders.
Yes, he's the number guy, yes.
Yeah. And he's called in because, he's the other one. There's the lady at the school, or lady at the nursery, and Ben Whistler.
And there's a great quote from the book that I liked about Ben. He's being asked by the cops, are you ready for this or whatever? And he's like, I've had the training. He says, I've had the training. I scored in the top 5%. And then he says, which was true except for the top 5%. Like any good figures man, Ben knew when to fiddle the numbers.
Really good. That's probably should have paid more attention to that line because that's important.
Well, and that's, a little foreshadowing there, which I also appreciated on my second reread.
Yeah.
So Ben gets helicoptered into the situation from headquarters and goes into the school and starts talking with Jamie and trying to figure out why he's there, what's going on, and pulling this information out of him. And we start to get these little snippets of what's going on and why he was there and what was happening. Because the issue is there has been a boatload of money that's gone missing. And they think that Myro Weiss, who is Jamie's boyfriend, is the one that has skedaddled with that money. And so everybody's on the hunt for the money to try and track it down.
Right. That's why Bad Sam and the other guy are chasing Jamie, because they figure he knows where Myro is. At least that's the assumption. Yeah.
And we learn a little bit about Myro as well, right? Because he's called the Mirror Man because of his name.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been tracking the money in Iraq that has been going over there to pay for reconstruction. And that's where we get one of the meanings of this book's title, because it's revolving around the reconstruction of Iraq and all of the money that's being spent to ostensibly rebuild things, but more likely going to line everybody's pockets, right?
And the theory seems to be, depending on who you ask, that Myro has, like Ben, he knows how to work the numbers. Myro has worked the numbers and taken a significant chunk of cash.
Like $250 million, I think, is what they say. So it's, you're not going to fit that in a duffel bag.
No. And so you can understand why people would be interested in finding this.
Yes.
And why they would send someone collect poor Jamie.
Yeah. They have these conversations, and we have various little blips in the story to try and goose the action that's happening. At one point, everybody has to go to the bathroom, right? And so, you know, and then we have Louise calling back. She's actually kept her phone with her, and she calls her mom, who is just utterly confused about, she's like, why am I calling her? What am I going to say other than, you know, I love you, and... You know, and then Jamie gets a phone, you know, and so he's got a phone to talk to people. And at one point, Judy makes a break for the door, and it's, you know, this terrifying scene, and yet also, again, slightly comic, right? Because she makes a run for the door and falls down into they all kind of collapse together, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a very slapsticky kind of thing there. And it would be amusing if there wasn't a sniper across the street.
Right.
With all of them in his sights.
Yeah. Yes, who is another person that we meet, right? D.S. Bane, who, again, we get this little snapshot of this person who had previously, just a couple of months before, had to shoot somebody else, like in a hostage situation. And so the question is, can Bane do it again? Do we trust that Bane knows what they're doing and is able to kill somebody when in this situation, because the killing, although justified in the police sense, wasn't maybe deserved because the person had a gun, but it wasn't like an ancient old gun that wasn't even loaded, right? And that's why they took the shot. And there's a lot of like this kind of comedy with the cops where they've managed to send everybody off that actually is capable for dealing with one of these situations. And their superiors don't want to let them call in for assistance. And it's really just, you get the sense of the passing of the buck.
Yeah.
That was really pretty fun.
Yeah, we got to keep a budget down. We got to keep things, and we do have Bane, who's not quite fit for active duty, but he's close enough. And yeah, everyone else is off in training.
Yeah.
As is the head of the school. She's off.
Yeah, I think she was at the dentist or something. Yes.
But yeah, so all the people who should be there making things work better, making things work smoother, are not there. We just got second-run players.
Which is just, it felt real, too, right? Like, that's exactly what happens, right? The only time things go wrong are at the time when you don't have all the people who have trained and prepared and are utterly ready to do this, right? It's, you end up with the B team or like one A and a B and a C and a, you know, Z, you know, that's nothing runs perfectly when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Speaking of the head teacher, how often did you stop and think, is she the lady? Is Jamie stuck with just the wrong people entirely?
Yeah, for sure. You don't know, you know, and one of the things having read Heron before is you can't trust yourself necessarily. The most likely outcome is definitely probably not what's going on. One of these days he's going to write a real straightforward thing where there is none of that narrative tricks, and you'll just be shocked because you expected the big twist and it wasn't there. So they go back and forth a few times talking about this, and then Whistler does something that definitely on the second read, I was like, okay, that should have been a clue if I didn't pick up on it the first time. He starts playing this music, right, to block what they're saying, because the phone that they had given Jamie was bugged, obviously, so that they could hear what was happening. Ben flushes it down the toilet and then starts playing music so that their directional microphones won't hear what he's talking about. And Ben is saying that this is because he's worried that the people trying to kill Jamie, Bad Sam, and Neil Ashton, I think is the other guy, are out there listening. And he's the good guy, right? Ben is trying to keep Jamie safe.
And I bought it.
Yeah.
This is a guy who works for spy agency, so he's picked up on the tricks, and he's just worried about what's going to happen to them. He's worried that Bad Sam is going to get just enough information so that he's not going to care anymore what happens to these five, and he'll just arrange for them all to disappear. So this is their best shot, is that he will block Bad Sam from getting information and at the same time try to resolve the hostage situation.
Yeah.
And like, oh, I'm in. What a good guy.
And Heron does something, it's not super subtle, but it is good in that he has this, the head dog, which is a term that carries over to Slow Horses. Bad Sam is the head dog. He's the one charged with keeping kind of everybody under control. And he gives them the name Bad Sam, right? Right off the bat, you're like, okay, this guy is not maybe somebody that we should be trusting.
Right, yeah.
Although it's less about whether he's a good or a bad person as much as he's not somebody to tussle with, right?
Right, yeah. He's not someone to tussle with. He's really not much of a team player. He's bad, and you don't want to work with the guy.
Yes. Well, and he's also, it's interesting to read this knowing that next comes Slow Horses, because he's almost like a proto Jackson Lamb. I think Jackson Lamb, sure, in the Slow Horses books, you know, you see a lot of those things. He knows his job very well. He's not somebody that other people want to hang around with. There's a few things that happen, like he makes a cigarette appear out of nowhere. That's a very Jackson Lamb thing that we see, mm-hmm, in the books. So it felt like Heron was kind of trying out that kind of a character that we later see kind of fully bloom in the books after this. So he's trying to trace things back as well. On his end, he's meeting with Louise's mom. He's talking to Judy's. Judy just rents a room in this house, and so he talks to her landlady, who is just a terrible person as well.
Yes.
You know, so those two were made for each other. And Ben is trying to keep Jamie safe, and so he starts to get him releasing some of these people that we've met, right? So Judy is the first out.
Yes, and that has everything to do with no one wants her in the room.
Yes, because she's just like this lump on the floor, right? He mm-hmm. talks about how she's just like kind of laying there, just as like moaning occasionally.
Yeah, and I want to feel bad for her. I really do, because she has had a rough couple of years, and it would sour anyone. But wow, I've worked with Judy's. You know, if you're in a meeting for several hours and you can find a way to get Judy out of the room, you're getting Judy out of the room, for sure. And if it buys you more time with the police, all the better.
Yeah. So she leaves, and then before Elliot can leave, he wants to hear the end of the story, right? So before he goes with his children, he's like, wait, I have one more question. And they're like, no, just go. No, he's like, no, I want to know what happened in Iraq, you know, right? He wants to know the ending to the story, which is totally fascinating.
I want to get away from this horrible situation, but man, I got to find, you know, got to get to the end of the book.
It's true, though. And it's funny because there starts to become this like banter between Louise, Ben, and Elliot, where they're both kind of bouncing. Like Jamie stopped talking, and they start like jumping in and filling in the pieces and figuring out the story, right? Which I thought was really funny.
Yeah, and then there's a point where Jamie's like, "Hey, remember me?
The guy with the gun."
Yeah, I've got this thing that you're all focused on. Let's pay attention to me again. So once the money stuff comes up in Jamie and Ben as they're talking, once the money stuff comes up, that's when Louie's like, oh, I'm clearly who you came to talk to, because mm-hmm. I used to work in banking and I can understand what might have happened and how easy it would be for someone in Miro and Ben's position to move this money. They need to know someone like me or my boss or my former boss. We're the ones who could get this done.
Yeah, and her boss previously had talked about some kind of scheme that sounds slightly similar to what they're talking about here, right? This kind of once it's zeros and ones, making the money appear and disappear is a lot easier to move mm-hmm. it around. So
yeah.
So Elliot finally does leave, right? And there's this moment of reunion between him and the kids and the wife, and they're kind of pushed away to the truck to wait with Judy. Mm-hmm. And that was where I thought there was a really nice moment, though, where there's a couple of things about Elliot leaving that I thought were really great. There's the moment with Bane where Bane sees him walk out, and there's this little almost like a monologue from Bane's mind, because they're looking through this rifle scope and can see his face, and they see that in addition to like relief of leaving, there's this embarrassment of not having done something right. And there's this little thing about the hero that you want to be and that you can't be. You know, not everybody is able to do what they think is they would do in these situations. And I think that's definitely a theme with his character, right? Is that he's somebody who thinks he is capable of doing the right thing, and then mm-hmm. maybe when it comes down to it, he's not doing the wrong thing necessarily, but he's definitely not doing the heroic thing.
Right. Yeah, I thought about that a lot. And, in my employment, we have to watch every few months an active shooter training video. Mm. And there's all these scenes of you're supposed to run, you're supposed to hide, or you're supposed to fight if you have no other choice. And there's these scenes of someone in the office grabbing a fire extinguisher, someone, they're going to get the gunman as he walks in through the door. And Elliot thinks he should have done that. He should be that guy. His whole life, he assumed he was going to be that guy. And when he had the opportunity, no, because his defense is, well, he had these toddlers clinging to his legs, so he obviously couldn't do anything. But no. No, toddler or not.
No.
Elliot's not doing anything heroic.
Right, and it's the 4 a.m. thing, right? Where it's like, and I think we've all been there in certain times, you know, there's stresses and there's the things that, like, you wake up in the middle of the night that just give you that anxiety, whether about things that you should have done or didn't do or still mm-hmm. have to do. And that's kind of where they're talking about. Like, this is the thing that when yeah. he wakes up at 4 a.m., he's going to be thinking back on, you know, I had the chance to do something heroic and I didn't. And the other part of it is there's never going to be another moment like this for these people, right? This is their moment, you know, almost in the sun, right, of these things. And they talk about that repeatedly, right? Each character kind of brings up the fact that this, you know, they never would have expected this, but this is their moment. And Louise mm-hmm. talks about it, right? How she's looking, already kind of looking back on what she's done and thinking that she's doing it because she wants to be the hero, right?
Yeah. This is the first line of their obituary that they're living right now.
Yes.
Whether that obituary is written tomorrow or years from now, this is the first line, and they all know that. One of the great things is that we do get the perspective of all the different characters, so they all know that this is their moment and they are not living up to it, at least the way that they would want to. But at the same time, they're realizing survival means a lot more to me than I realized. I just want to get out of it. I mean, Elliot wants to get the end of the story, but he wants to get out of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great way of framing it, you know, is because how often does our heroism survive, you know, impact with reality?
Yeah.
There's what we can think up in our head about how we would behave, and then there's the truth. And
mm-hmm.
they rarely intersect, right, when we're honest with ourselves. And I think Heron does a good job of kind of bringing that to the front.
We've all seen the TV shows. We've all seen the movies where the innocent bystander finds it within themselves to save the day. And none of us are that people. That's why we watch movies. That's why we watch TV. We, you know, that's not us. And these characters are so refreshing in that none of them are those people either.
Yeah. Well, and it plays into the fact that, you know, in everybody's mind, we're the hero of our own story. Yeah. And we see that in this and how that can play tricks on us in the end, right? Especially with mm-hmm. Louise, because she's somebody who comes face to face with that, I think.
Yeah. And she gets so close.
Well, and it's there's a great scene, and I'm just going to skip ahead because I think we're talking about it and I think it fits here. You know, when she gets out, she goes to try and confront her boss, her former boss. It doesn't work out, and she ends up running into Bad Sam because he's tracked her there because he mm-hmm. knew that's where she'd go, because he needs to know what they talked about in there. He needs to know what was being said.
Right.
There's this great line where Bad Sam was like, "Did you have any siblings?"
Yes. And yeah, I wrote, like, that one down too. Yeah.
She's like, "What?" And he's like, "Did you have brothers or sisters?" And she's like, "No." And he says, "Ah, well, there you go. You know, you have always been the star of your own mm-hmm. story. You know, you can't imagine that there's anybody other than you, because you are not the lady." Right?
Yes. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. You were an only child, weren't you? Because you think you're the star. You think you know, the world revolves around you and that you're going to save the day. And no, I just need to know what happened in there. I just need you to answer a couple of questions. But she doesn't stop. She keeps going.
Right. Well, that's the thing, right?
Yeah, she's still the star of the show in her own mind, because she's going to meet up with Ben and save the day.
Now, to jump back a little bit, we were talking about Elliot and how he's realized he's not the hero he thought he was. But we get that scene in the van where, you know, he's reunited with his family
mm-hmm.
or his wife, and the kids are with her, and he's feeling kind of like third wheel-ish there at that point.
Yeah.
And so he goes over to Judy because he sees her just kind of slumped down in the front. And he's going over there to comfort her. And then all of a sudden, it's like a reversal where he just breaks down and she's comforting him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was a great moment, you know, of kind of for him and for Judy. And it really, because we don't really see them again, I thought that was a great moment of closure for both of those characters. I thought he really put a pin in their stories very well.
Yeah. Judy goes out on a win, which was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poor Elliot. Yeah. He's reunited with his wife, and it's all back to what it was yesterday.
You know,
it's mom and the twins, and he's standing outside looking in.
But when he goes to Judy, then they all come over and kind of they have this, like, Judy Elliott, the mom and the twins group hug moment there, which I think that was really pretty great.
Yeah.
At the same time that's happening, though, Louise has gone and got a car and a phone for Ben and Jamie because they're going to walk out. Presumably, you know, Ben's going to drive Jamie to someplace where he can keep him safe and get to his MI6 superiors. And Louise is watching this as they come out. And Ben does something, you know, that looking back on definitely seems a little shady. He takes the gun from Jamie and removes the bullets and gives it back to him. And then when they walk out, so he's carrying this unloaded gun, holding it to Ben's head, and Ben trips as he's walking out the door, which gives D.S. Bain the opportunity to take the shot that she has been waiting for, because I thought that was another interesting little twist, is that Bain is actually a woman. It doesn't necessarily play into the story at all, but it's just another way that Heron proves that he loves to, like, make you rethink all of your assumptions.
Yeah, right. I'd forgotten that till you said that, but yeah, once that's revealed, I, wait, what? You know, you had to flip back, and did I know this? Did I just conjure up this wrong impression? And, well, yeah, I did, but he let me.
Yeah, no, he loves to do that kind of stuff. And those are the kinds of things, though, that I do. You know, you do it too much and in too silly a way, it diminishes what you're doing, I think. But I don't think I think he knows when to walk that line. And I think this was one of those moments where he could do that. And he did it well, and it worked.
But yeah, that trip, like, oh, no.
Yeah.
So tragic.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you're feeling like, okay, things are moving forward. We're going to go to the next level. And then it's just like all the rugs pulled out from under you, right? And you're like, oh, now what?
Right. Oh, this poor kid, he started to have a glimmer of hope, and it's taken away from him. And, wow, I just hope, you know, you're thinking at the time, I just hope that they're still able to find Myro and the money and maybe have some sort of happy ending for Ben and Louise and that Bad Sam is foiled.
Yes.
Such an innocent moment, really, for the
Yes, because that's kind of the end of part one, and we go into part two, where it's the afternoon, and Ben is helicoptered back to the headquarters. He's going to go and, you know, meet with the bosses to talk through stuff, but we're still led to believe he's still a little nervous about what's going to happen with the dogs and Bad Sam. Is Bad Sam around? That's what kind of the refrain that keeps happening, right? And you think, oh, he's got to get out of there before Bad Sam gets to him.
Yep, he's got to get out of there before Bad Sam, or he's got to get to the bosses so he can give his perspective and maybe get some help in stopping Bad Sam from doing whatever nefarious things he's up to. You know, we're counting on Ben to save the day.
Yes, and so he ends up hitting Jed Moody, who ends up later in the next book, one of the slow horses, which I thought was fun. He just gets a little cameo there.
Oh, nice.
He does a runner, and, you know, we start to get a little bit more of the information. He goes to this kind of bolt hole that he had and sneaks into there, and we find out, oh, wait, Miro did steal the money, and he did want to do it, but he was doing it because he wanted to give it back to the Iraqi people and actually have it go to where it needed to be versus, you know, just being taken by all of these people who are just greedy and looking to make money.
Right. Yeah, he's a Robin Hood figure.
Yes.
With bad allies. Or bad accomplices.
Yes, because he's gotten Ben on his side. Ben's going to help him. But then we learn, well, he was going to help him to a point, right?
Right.
Because Ben, one of Ben's refrains throughout, you know, he was going on vacation. That's another thing that I love, that this little hint that maybe you should have noticed early on, is he keeps talking about, you know, he's going to go have margaritas and be on the beach somewhere. That was his vacation, was starting the next day. But we learn that was because he was actually going to ghost and go with all of this money, because he had been working with the guy who had gotten hit. So he goes to the hiding the safe house to get the passports that he was going to use, and finds that there was a gun in the safe that the guy hit by the car was going to use to kill him. So it was just like an endless double crossing going on here, right?
Yeah,
because presumably Miro is dead in a ditch somewhere, right? I mean, it's never said, but we, you know, that seems pretty obvious that they had killed him and he'll show up.
Yeah, we learn a lot about what happened, but we don't get all the details. Miro is gone, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Where, how, yeah, ultimately doesn't matter.
Yeah, and there's this nice line where Ben is thinking, dead bodies have a way of turning up. They either start to stink or whatever, you know, and you're like re-reeling it. You're like, okay, he's talking about Miro because he killed him, yeah, and knows where he's at, so...
Right.
But so he's got this gun that he keeps, the silencer, he puts that in his bag to carry it with him just because he's worried that the MI6 folks might catch up with him now that he escaped. And they are tracking his phone, and so you get this moment where they're tracking him around, and there's this little cat and mouse where they're trying to figure out, where is he going? Oh, he's on the shuttle to Heathrow. He's going to get to the plane and get out of there, and they got to catch him before he gets there, which, yeah, I thought was fun.
And like Chekhov said, you know, you put a gun in a backpack. And something's going to happen. And, yes, and so you're waiting. You're watching, you know, the reader is watching that backpack and that gun. It's going to be important.
And so, you know, MI6 is all in one place. But at the same time, you know, as we talked about, Louise does not like being told that she's not the center of the story, mm-hmm, and has gone to Paddington Station, wherever the Eurostar leaves, to watch for Ben there, because she thinks he's going to show up here. Or if he does, at least I'll be able to see him.
Yeah.
At the same time, all the MI6 guys are going to the other one, and it's revealed that Ben has actually done a little switcheroo. He threw his, you know, phone on there, but went to the other place, right? And so he's, mm-hmm, he's pretty good at this, you got to say, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for a guy who just watched the training videos, he picked up a lot.
So I didn't ask you. So what did you think about that reveal that he was the villain? When did that you finally put the pieces together and figured that part out?
That's a good. I'm not sure when, but as it became more revealed, it's like, okay, I like this. This is working for me. Obviously, not until the last page did I realize how good he was. Mm. I still had kind of like the hapless guy who finds himself in this conspiracy and he gets kind of swept up in it and doing the best of the bad situation. And yeah, he's a weasel, but yeah, still kind of pulling for him until the last little bit of reconstruction. And like, oh no, he's Lex Luthor all along. You know, it was very Usual Suspects kind of thing.
Mm, yeah.
You know, he's a bad guy all along, or at a certain point, like, oh, he's a little suspicious. Oh, he's a lot suspicious. No, he's the villain of the piece, but he still seems kind of hapless and bumbling. And then the further along I got at that point, it was just like, Heron did something wonderful here. You know, this is a little stroke of genius. I'm all here for it. Yeah.
Yeah, because he's got this impression of being like kind of the... definitely from the start, you know, he's got this rugby physique, you know, he's kind of a little, you know, he's got that leading man. You could easily see some leading man actor playing this role.
Sure.
And having you totally buy into him being the good guy throughout until the end, mm-hmm, when it's revealed. I think that would be a lot of fun to watch as, yeah, well. And I do, you know, thinking about that, though, I wonder... I don't think it would work as well on screen, at least for me. I think it would be harder to pull off because I think the way that he's able to mitigate the fear for the kids in, mm-hmm, a novel versus in a on-screen kind of a thing, I think that would have a different effect to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I don't... This doesn't seem easily adaptable. You'd have to mess with a lot of things, yeah.
Yeah. So Ben does, he's headed to the Eurostar and Louise sees him, right? And so she sees him going over and, because he'd forgotten, he nearly walked onto the train carrying this gun, which would have been, mm-hmm, bad for him.
Right.
So he drops it in a potted plant and we get this last little bit. And so what did you think about the ending?
For a second, I kind of got wrapped up in Louise's thinking that she's going to be the hero. I should have known better. I really should have. But I did. I got swept up in it. I'm not going to take the blame. I'm going to say Heron was so good he fooled me. It wasn't me being silly. But no, I like, oh, here we go. She picks up the gun. She's going to get everyone's attention and stop Ben from getting away, leaving the country. And we've got a nice, happy Hollywood ending. And no, because what happens to someone who flashes a gun at a bus terminal or an air terminal or anything like that post 9/11? It's not good.
Yeah. I mean, we end up basically back at the beginning kind of thing. It's like a nice little circular kind of thing going on here, right? Where we end up with a whole nother kind of a hostage situation happening, right? And he just kind of, mm-hmm, leaves us like kind of mid scene.
Right.
He doesn't explicitly play it out, but lets you use your imagination to imagine what happened there.
I hadn't put that together. Yeah. This is a circle and we're back at the beginning with the gun. It's a different gun, but it's a gun.
Yeah.
She's no longer the nursery teacher or an ex-banker. She's the gun.
Yeah, well, and she's kind of like it lost it, I gotta think, at this point, right? I mean, like, she's so lost in her own story, she can't see that she's making probably the worst mistake, worst decision right. possible, right?
Yeah, she's absolutely caught up.
Yeah.
And if she'd had 10 seconds to think, she wouldn't have done this.
But yeah.
She didn't have 10 seconds because he's at the automatic doors, so.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, we haven't really talked about explicitly is the humor in this book, because it's not... it's not a comedy, it's not a humorous book necessarily, but Heron does such a good job of weaving in, I don't know what the way to say it, like banter. Like, he's good at banter, mm-hmm. he's good at writing those kind of jokes from the narrator's point of view, right? Like the those kind of comments about stuff. Like even that quote that I had about Ben was knew how to work the numbers kind of a thing. He knows how to write those kind of jokes into his book without it turning into... mm-hmm. joke a minute kind of a thing, I guess.
Yeah, it's all from the narrator. You know, you could, James Patterson writes this book and it is dark and moody and straightforward and there's no humor at all. Mm-hmm. And it would have worked. I wouldn't have read it, but it would have worked. you know, I could easily see someone else doing that. But the narrator who pops in for a second to say, you're not going to see me ever again, her voice or their voice, I don't know why I assumed her, but it works for me. That narrator's voice is just so strong and so funny. I liken it to a magic act where the magician's doing everything with the left hand, you know, being flashy and telling jokes and doing stuff with the left hand, where the right hand is doing all the work. And that's what's going on in this situation. We're so taken up with the humor that we miss the drama, the tragedy, and the villainy. Because we are so focused on the other stuff.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of framing it. I think you're right, because he is so good at that misdirection. I mean, all of his books really do focus on trying to fool the reader in a way that doesn't make you feel that doesn't feel cheap, you know? Like, it's not like he's doing these things in a way that isn't really thought out. And I do think he could do a straight novel without any of those narrative tricks, and it would still be great because the writing is so sharp. You know, he's got such a good sense of what he's trying to do and how he wants to tell it that he doesn't need it. I like that he does it because I enjoy that, but I don't know that it's something that he would have to do. It's obvious that he enjoys doing that, and that's part of what makes the writing of the novels fun for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe the thing for me, why I haven't pushed on with Slow Horses, is that as much as I liked the book and appreciated the book, I thought the characters were interesting, but I wasn't dying to know what happened next. I'm kind of curious to know what's going to happen next, but I'm not staying in the palace with the gun to find out what happens to Jackson Lamb and the crew next. But what Reconstruction has shown me, and I picked this up in Slow Horses, I want to see what Heron does next. So I'm coming back to the series probably next month because I got to dive in. Also, that allows me to listen to the rest of your podcast series. You know, because that's really what's important, right?
Exactly. More podcast listens.
The big thing that won me over in this book was the writing. I got to get more of Heron's prose and see what he does, see what tricks he does, or what oddball characters that no one else in the world would spend 50 pages on. Is he going to get me invested in?
Yeah. If folks are foolishly still listening and they haven't read the book, I think the thing that you can't put into words is just some of the stuff that he does narratively is really, really smart as far as the way he cuts between these characters, these situations, flashes back to give you more depth about what their thoughts and who they are. I mean, I think... he did a really good job in this book of creating some really believable characters that I was invested in seeing more of. And I think that is something that I was really impressed with.
Yeah. And like you mentioned earlier, the onion peeling, that, okay, we think we understand Ben and Elliot and Louise, and then he peels back a little bit more, like, while pushing the narrative forward or doing the flashback, both give us a better understanding of these people. We have to go back and reevaluate or reconstruct everything that we've seen before. And he does that several times. At one point in time, you might be having some sympathy for Elliot at the beginning of the book. Like, oh, okay, he's going to get out of this loveless marriage and he's going to take a shot at love. And then, like, no, he's just a creep who took advantage of a drunken night. And then, well, no, he's, you know, he's a dad. He's trying to do his own thing. And, you know, you keep shifting what you think of him, for example, or all the characters, almost every third chapter, you have to stop and like, well, okay, what do I think about this person? What do I think about what they're going through? Once I finished the book, I went and I tried to come up with a list. I came up with like 10 to 15 different things that the title could be telling you that needs to be reconstructed. I don't normally spend a whole lot of time on titles, but why this title? Because that doesn't seem to fit. You know, The Gun. That's a good title. Or something like that. And then, yeah, okay, is it about reconstruction in Iraq? Is it about reconstructing the events of the palace? And really, that's what you should be doing at least every other chapter in this novel, is stopping and reevaluating and reconstructing what you think is going on. You're wrong at least about something.
Yes, up until exactly the last right. page. You're right. Yeah, no, I definitely think so. You've got to reevaluate and constantly be thinking a couple of steps ahead.
And it was such a great way that he did that because I like this guy. 5 pages later, nope, this is a horrible person, and you know. And then another 5 pages later, yeah. That was the best part of the book. I mean, I don't think I have anything negative to say about the book, but that was the best part to me, was just not knowing and being forced to reevaluate and reconsider everything time and time again. And the way that he did that, just it seemed effortless. Could not be effortless on his part. But it felt just so natural, so I had to like physically stop, put the book down. Like, okay, wait, what exactly is going on here? Because you get swept up by that voice, being the only child, or being good with numbers, or some of the ways that, you know, Judy bemoans her life, or at least, you know, her internal monologue.
Yeah.
You know, you stop and you think, oh, that's funny. And you miss the rabbit being put into the hat, but you're not noticing.
Yes, because one of the things that I don't think we'd mentioned, Judy is the lady.
Yeah, all along. She was never my guess.
Yes, no, exactly, right? And her husband was the one that was involved in reconstruction, and that's why, because he was a friend of Miro's, right? So that's,
yeah,
again, somebody he ran into in Iraq. So that's great. I mean, it was just all of those things are really things that Heron loves to do and does very well, are those kind of narrative tricks.
Right, a guy that we only know as the cheating philanderer who died ages before the book starts is the pivotal character.
Yeah, I got to highlight a couple of things that I feel like really do make this kind of like a early Slow Horses novel.
Mm-hmm.
We get something, there's a moment where we kind of see the whole situation through the eyes of a bird as it's kind of flying mm-hmm. over everything, and he kind of gives an overview of what's going on. And that's very much like the beginning of the Slow Horses series books, where we take the eyes of he's done it a number of different ways, either a cat or the wind or the sun or whatever, but it's the view of Slough House, and it kind of mm-hmm. sets everything up, and he kind of picked that little bit and stuck it at the front of his Slow Horses books,
yeah,
which I thought was interesting. And one of the other things is at the very end, when Louise, she goes to find her boss, right? And she goes to where she used to work, which is the financial area down close to the Barbican. Then she's in a taxi. She hops out. She walks to the train station. And based on the description, I've been there. She's getting on at Barbican Station. And she's walking probably right in front of Slough House, which, you know, obviously hadn't sure. been thought of when he wrote this book. But that's definitely what's happening there, which is pretty funny to me, just mm-hmm. as the books are kind of connected together. I definitely appreciated that little bit.
Oh, that is nice. Yeah.
Because that's where Heron worked before, while he was writing these books.
Right.
So it was obviously he was very familiar with that area and had to include it in the book. So sure. I thought that was pretty funny.
It was in there. That one of the bits of that really grabbed me, I think it was in that part, like she says, or she's thinking, you know, even now with rush hour fading, people piled past like lemmings, which she'd lately read weren't the suicidal types legend painted, the abrupt declines in their population, less to do with mass clifftop dives than with hungry predators, Arctic foxes, owls, and the like. Which was more realistic, but disappointing too. Suicide had been the one thing everyone knew about lemmings. Now it turned out they didn't even have that going for them. If they weren't depressed before, that should do it. That's that humor. It takes you out of the moment, makes you forget all the intense stuff going on. And also, there's some reconstruction. There's some reconsidering. Here's another fact that changes everything, and that should depress you. Louise should have gotten a few more of those facts and had to change her thinking about her own situation, but sadly she didn't have time for that.
Well, and we get another a moment where she should be reconsidering herself, right? Because when she encounters, right before that scene that, you know, we were talking about, she runs into somebody who she used to work with, who she says, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with you. You didn't call me. You didn't reach out at all. And she's like, well, actually, I did call. I left a couple of messages. You never called me back. You're the one that didn't want to have any interaction. And Louise isn't capable of, she doesn't believe it, right? We're told that she's not buying it. And at the same time, I feel it's very believable that after that happened, she wanted nothing to do with anybody else. And so just deleted any kind of, her former friend, her version of things feels more true to me than Louise's imagined view of things.
Right. Yeah. Louise, when she left that job, she had a narrative in mind and she cut everything. And woe is me, because I was all alone. And no, not really. You weren't. There were people there who might have at least been a friend.
Yeah. Well, and it's just to your point of that reconstructing our past and whether we're capable of doing that or not, you know, are we capable of having that ability to have that frame shift? I mean, she even struggles figuring out when Bad Sam tells her, oh, that thing you saw where Ben slipped, quote unquote, you know, do you really think that was true? And she struggles with that too. You know, you see her trying to reframe things again and again in her mind to see the truth that was there all along, but she has to put the facts in a different order to see what's going on. So
yeah, that's not her forte.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, what's another author? Because, you know, for me, I've read all of his novels now. I've read a couple of times. So what other authors do you feel kind of remind you of his work and that you would say, hey, if you really like McCarran, you should try this?
You know, you told me in the email you're going to be asking me this, and I'm not sure. While I was reading this, I thought of a Noah Hawley novel, Before the Fall. Have you read that one?
I haven't read that one yet. No, I've got it, but I haven't read it.
The narrative approach is very similar. You pick up with this artist and a child who had been on a private plane going from New England to New York. Plane blows up. These two are the only survivors. You find them in the middle of the Atlantic swimming to shore. And then the narrative is two things. It's pushing forward with the investigation and the aftermath, the plane disaster, with flashbacks like Karen does in this one, with all the people who happen to be on the plane, from the pilot and the stewardess to the people who owned the plane or rented the plane and all the passengers, telling the story in the same kind of, you know, onion peeling way without the humor. it's a very, I mean, there might be a couple of, oh, that's a nice moment, but that narrative structure is kind of the same way. And you don't know and you don't know and you don't know. And then you kind of start putting the pieces together. As I recall, the reader gets to put the pieces together a lot quicker than the characters do, which is always nice. But remind me of that. As far as like voice and stuff like that, man, I don't know if there's anyone. There was The Appeal. It was a book, came out, I think, in January in the States. It was setting the world on fire in the UK most of last year. Actually, her second book is already out there. We haven't got it. But it had it's not the same kind of voice, but they do the same thing. There's these wonderful characters, and they all have these fantastic voices, and you're getting swept up in kind of the comedy without seeing the nasty, dark crime that's actually...
Who's that by?
Janice Hallett. It's called The Appeal.
Okay. Well, I'll look that one up.
Voice-wise, that's the first thing that comes to mind. But yeah, the Before the Fall, structurally, seems similar.
Okay.
And it's been too long since I read the rest of Hawley's stuff. I don't know. I don't think that's how he always does things, but that one, he did.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of another book that reminds me of this particular book, and not maybe one of his others. The closest I can think of recently that I read that I really loved, and it's very different, but it's also kind of slightly adjacent, I guess, is The Anomaly. Have you read that yet?
No.
It's by a French author.
Okay.
It's about, again, an air flight. Basically, it's about these people on this plane who appear, and the plane that they were in actually landed like 4 months before that, and this is a duplicate of all of these people.
Okay.
And so it's very weird, but you really, the author does a great job of kind of mixing genres. You know, you've got this kind of sci-fi element, but you've also got these like personal kind of melodrama stuff going on with the people. You learn about all of these different characters, how they interact with this crazy thing that's happened, and how that changes, you know, just how these few months have seen certain things change. Mm-hmm. It's really good. I really recommend that one. I can't say the author's name, but The Anomaly. I'll put a link in the show notes for that one as well. But it's really good. It's really good.
Okay. I guess, you know, there is a certain Chandler, Warby Parker-esque feel where, you know, their first-person narrator will kind of, you know, quip their way in the narration through a scene that kind of matches Heron, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
But I think if you like one, you might like the other kind of thing.
Sure. Well, HC, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk Reconstruction with me. This is great.
Yeah, I had a blast both reading this and this conversation. Thanks, Jeff.
If folks want to find you and keep up with your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
TheIrresponsibleReader.com, please.
Well, and you're on Twitter too, right?
I'm a horrible tweeter. I'm one of the world's worst. But yeah, at HC Newton.
I'll put links to, you know, your website and Twitter feed in the episode show notes as well. So I hope folks go on there and start reading, finding some new reads, because you've got every day you got some fresh stuff. I don't know how you read that much. I seriously I'm barely able to keep up with the reading that I'm doing for podcasts. So
yeah, no, like I said, it's a hobby that has gotten out of hand, and I don't mind. But
all right, well, that's great. Thanks again. This episode kicks off season 2 of Barbican Station. The next couple episodes, we're going to do a look at Dolphin Junction that I promised. I'm hoping to do a look at some of the audiobook versions of the Slough House series as well. And also recapping episodes of the TV series, which starts up on April 1st. So all that and more is leading up to the next Slough House book, Bad Actors, which comes out in May. I've written a bunch on the Slow Horses on my site, including up-to-the-minute updates on the TV show. If you type slough.house in your web browser, it'll take you right there. That's slough.house. And you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Barbican Station. If you want more Spy Talk, you can always go to spywrite.com. That's right with a W. For more Spy Talk, or find me on Twitter at spywrite. That's going to do it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, take 2 seconds. Go on, whatever you're listening to this on, Apple Podcast, Audible, Amazon Music, Spotify, whatever. If you don't mind, just leave a quick review. It's going to let other folks know that the show is worth giving a shot. And if you want, drop me a comment telling me what you thought. Until next time, thanks for listening.